Hi there, my name's Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks presented to you by Harman. And this episode, we're going to take a look through the keyhole into the world of home studios and find out, can you hear the difference when something is recorded at home? What role does the equipment play and how can you start your own studio? To help us address the big questions for small spaces, I'm thrilled to be joined by a pair of audio experts who would know their way around any studio on the planet, large or small. Welcome to the podcast, Damien Curry, Global Product Manager for AKG and JBL Professional at Harman, and also a musician and one of an elite team of composers for film and TV.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on. This is pretty awesome.
And welcome to the podcast, Robbie Dunn, studio design veteran, experienced pro audio buyer, home and project studio build advisor and recording artist, and also co-founder of IDYR. Welcome, Robbie.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
So let's start with a bit of background now. You've both moved from major league recording studios to more home-based setups in different ways. What's been your path from those massive control rooms with flying fader desks and walls of outboard to home and project studio setups? So it's time for your origin stories, and we'll start with yourself, Damien.
That's great. So I started off as a guitar player, you know, playing in garage bands and when you actually had to physically play in garage bands. I started playing not too long after that, I started playing in church choirs, and that kind of transitioned into recording my own music, recording guitar for other people. And that's where my introduction to the studio was essentially just moving from being a guitar player and playing on sessions. What I found was there was a time when getting into a recording studio, and it's still like this, but you couldn't record anything decent for, you know, less than $100 an hour. Oh, yeah. And obviously that came with the engineer and, you know, all the expertise of the studio cats. And I think in the mid-2000s, when Pro Tools and different interfaces started to be released with good sample rates and whatnot, people started to transition to recording from home. Also combined with that was when computer technology became, you know, a lot cheaper to buy a decent computer and record at home. That's when it all really started to shift.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've been kind of seeing that from a perspective of a musician and also a composer as well. And Robbie, coming over to yourself, I suspect studio cats and guitars might feature a bit in your origin story. So what's been your path as a musician into the big studios and then more into working in project and home setups?
So my path's very, very similar to Damien's. So I also was a guitar player in various bands. And it was always a case of the home recording thing. It was really more down to economics of the projects I was being offered at the time. Coming off playing gigs and being part of the songwriting team for various bands I was in. I'm sure, as you remember back then, decent recording studio was about 2,000 quid a day, which, yeah, considering that was the 80s, that's like an astronomical. It was the price of a car per day. And then as Damien said, the home audio revolution kind of started in that kind of early 90s when samplers start appearing and sort of desks that did like sound actually okay, had usable EQ, hard disk recording start becoming available. You know, you had the classic Atari running all your sequences. So home recording actually became a possibility because really you had, prior to that, a very two-tiered studio setup. You had those kind of very projecty studios built around things like, you know, Fostex R8s and E16s, which, yeah, you know, you may as well be recording onto a cassette tape, really, at the end of the day. The gauge was so narrow, you know.
Oh my God, so true.
You're fitting, yeah, even, I remember a friend of mine bought an 8-track cassette recorder. So imagine the bandwidth on that thing. And the crosstalk was crazy. It was absolutely unusable. But once hard disk recorders came along, like the Akai boxes that came out with a Roland, they totally revolutionized. And then obviously things like, you know, DAWs once computers caught up. That totally changed the market. I've always used big studios though in tandem because there's certain things you can't really do in home studios, like record strings or record drums really well, or mixing, or especially mastering. There's those kind of final stage processes. But generally, I kind of run the two in tandem. If it's recording guitars or tracking vocals or programming, just makes complete sense to do those things at home. And then if you do need, you know, the big Led Zeppelin drum sound or a string quartet, there's only really one way of doing that, and that's having a physical space to record it in.
I think one of my first recorders was the Sony mini disc. It was a 4-track mini disc player or recorder. And it was, you know, this was probably the mid-90s or whenever that was. You realize then, like, you aspire to have the sound that you hear on all these records. And then you start recording. You're like, wait, why doesn't this sound like these records? And then you start, that takes you down a whole other path of, well, they use the mixing desk. Well, what's a mixing desk? what's a mic preamp? And that leads to this whole discovery mission of trying to like capture. So the trajectory of trying to record, you record at home and then you just find out that you have to be in a big studio. You have to be somewhere that costs, you know, an arm and a leg. And that's just not the case anymore.
Oh my word, absolutely. I remember those days. Everything was expensive, time-consuming, didn't always work. But now we are in this age of advanced technology, computer recordings, digital audio workstations, beautiful audio in-outs, you know, all the good stuff that you can get into a bedroom studio is just phenomenal. And in fact, as some of our listeners might be aware, Billie Eilish famously recorded vocals for her album in her brother Phineas's bedroom. So, you know, Robbie, do you think that home recordings are the new normal, or does it kind of work in parallel, or how have things changed in terms of consumers and their reaction to stuff recorded at home?
Yeah, absolutely. The reality is now is that the quality of digital recording, even on a tiny budget, is amazing. You know, like most interfaces now, like literally every interface in the market, not unless you're going to go for something unbelievably cheap, but anything above even £100 now, you can get proper recordings. You could present them as a record. The real challenge is, and I think this is where the Billie Eilish case study or whatever you want to call it is interesting, is it was all recorded in their bedroom, and I think they used like, you know, a £200 mic, and there was nothing fancy. It was Logic with just the actual stock plugins and so on.
Wow.
But they had it mixed properly. It was mixed in a proper studio and it was mastered in a proper studio. So I think people who are trying to get that, you know, take something like Bad Guy, which has got that amazing low end on it and stuff. I think, experience would be the thing that would enable you to do that on a cheap setup. So I think sometimes, you know, if you want to get that where your record's got to stand up against everything else out there, sometimes you will need to get some professionals involved or move it at some stage to an actual studio, really just for it, so you can hear properly. But even again, like, you know, you look at studio monitors now, like what was available back then as home studio monitors versus now, you know, the quality of now is incredible. So the only thing I think that holds people back and why they don't in this day and age with the plugins we have and the DAWs we have and the quality of equipment we have, it really is just coming down to experience and understanding EQ, for example, you know, because a lot of people will just, you know, won't know where to cut and pull things and shape stuff and frequencies smashing into each other and then over-compressing things. People just going mental with the compression, basically, you know, and then just not having any dynamic room for anything to breathe and things to sit alongside each other and so on. But could you make a record in a bedroom? Mm. Absolutely. Like, I don't know if you've heard that Fetch the Bowl Cutters, the last few Apple album. Done in GarageBand. I mean, but what makes it brilliant is she kind of took that Tom Waits approach of found sounds, finding something in the kitchen that makes a cool sound that becomes a percussive instrument on it and so on. So I think the other thing that where home recordings probably fall down a little bit is probably just down to laziness or everyone using the same sort of sounds because, you know, everyone uses the same whatever piano preset and every drum preset and so on.
Yeah,
so,
same libraries.
Same libraries, you know, same sound vendors across the whole board. But I think, again, imagination and experience are the two things that I think that transform you know, your home recording into something special, because the equipment really doesn't hold you back at this stage. If we were to get our time machine and go back into the late 80s and 90s and someone said, here you go, here's a DAW from 2022, you'd be like, wow. You can do what? Yeah, you can bend and shape the audio any way you want in real time. You'd be like, no.
But, you know, it sounds like we have amazing equipment, better than we've ever had before. There's more stuff that's actually charting and selling lots of records and reaching millions of listeners all over the world. It's recorded at home, but the big unlock is creativity, not being afraid to experiment and do something different. And Damien, now you've seen like the whole range of studio spaces as a musician, as a composer. What's your take on the kind of quality that you can get from a home setup? Do you think bedroom recording could be the new normal?
Oh, absolutely. The reason why it could be a new normal is because what's important is the barrier prior to the last, I don't know how many years, has been getting the recording itself to sound good. You know, like Robbie said, there's so many different interfaces right now that are really high quality. It's really hard to get one that sounds bad, if you will.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different options out there that allow you to get into the computer at really high sample rates, at really high fidelity.
Yes.
And also, there's a lot of really good microphones and mic preamps that are really, really affordable that you can capture, you know, really great recordings at home with. I think probably the biggest challenge when it comes to capturing recordings at home is going to be the acoustic space that you're in. Mm. Obviously, you know, if you're in an apartment, you probably can't mic your guitar amp. You know, in some of those cases, it is necessary to be in a physical space that will allow, you know, that doesn't have SPL constraints and whatnot. But aside from just getting a great recording, it's easier now than ever. You don't have to do any advanced studies. That said, though, I think that it's still important, and I don't believe this piece is going anywhere. I think it's still extremely important to know the basics, to know how EQ works, to know how compression works, and more importantly, know how gain staging works, you know, and how to properly gain stage. I also mix as well, in addition to compose, and I mix for other people. And sometimes you get, you know, you get recordings and you get sessions that you can tell, you know, whomever recorded it does have an idea of how to gain stage. And then you can also tell the opposite. You know, when you see a file and you see, you know, a drum kit and, you know, you've got stuff all over the place, you got phasing, you know, or you get a set of stems that you have things all over the place. You got some things sometimes clipping. And I can tell then that even though someone was able to afford the equipment and they have the creativity, they don't have that, some of those very basic rites of passage, if you will, that you learn by being inside of a studio. You know, you can't just set up a drum kit or a guitar amp and just go. There is a little bit of care that needs to take place in there. So I think as long as people are, or creators are, getting some of those foundational elements right, the world is your oyster. The fact that, you know, people are recording in different spaces actually could be to the benefit. I mean, you know, you can acoustically treat a room, but your room actually has a sound, and that sound actually might be something that you like, you know.
Yeah.
But if you listen to I don't know why this comes to mind, but the Red Hot Chili Peppers record, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, that came out in the early 90s, there's the song Breaking the Girl. There's during the bridge section, there's a really heavy percussion piece that comes in. And if you ever go back and watch the recording, it's literally them recording in a kitchen in a mansion on Laurel Canyon in LA, and they're recording pots and pans inside the kitchen. And it's that kind of thing that, you know, if those things make it onto recordings, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a great professionally tuned space for it to sound good.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point about, you know, leveraging the room space if you can. One of my favorite producers of all time, Brian Eno, is a great exponent of that, actually finding the right space and making that part of the recording. So that could be an unexpected benefit of a home studio set up there. That's absolutely brilliant. Now, you both have an insider's view for sure of what's been happening with recording equipment and what's happening now. What kind of trends have you been observing? What's the Harman perspective, Damien, on where we're all going with recording equipment?
I think that like most people or in this industry, immersive audio is the go-to thing right now. That's the big thing. You know, you've got, you know, all these record labels, some of the major record labels re-releasing old albums, having Atmos mixes and mixed in immersive. So that's actually where the industry is going. And I don't think that's a secret to anyone. So from a recording perspective, capturing great recordings, there's a classic vibe to that, meaning, you know, it's one of those things where it's kind of not broke, so why fix it? But then starting to kind of go into the direction of Atmos, you start to get outside of the recording piece and start to look at, you know, more post-production, more mixing in more than just stereo.
100%. And we had a fantastic previous episode of Audio Talks with three incredible immersive audio experts. So if you want to know a bit more about that, just search for Audio Talks Immersive Audio and you're in for a treat. And Robbie, what say you about trends in recording equipment, more use of software or plugins or anything like that? You know, you've moved from having loads of physical equipment to a lot of virtual equipment as well as physical equipment.
Yeah, I literally work off a laptop these days. I've got huge storage space, but racks and racks and racks of outboard. It's just a pure convenience. Like, an interesting note as well on the immersive thing is the democratization of that, which Apple just did by making the Dolby plugins as part of the new version of Logic, which I thought was very interesting. You know, that means then it's a level, incredibly level playing field, whereas as before, that would have been for the, you know, the super studios. But I think now the fact that a kid in the bedroom can also mix in immersive, you know,
that's amazing. That's
incredible. But with plugins, yeah, plugins have come on leaps and bounds. The emulations are just incredible. You know, like we have AB'd them against the actual units, and you're never going to be 100% there, because the reality is, if you put 511-76s up against each other, they'll all sound different, because they'll all be made on different years. The capacitors will be better in others. Some have different power supplies. Some will have different transformers. But if you were to average it out across, you know, we tried all the various emulations from all the big plug-in manufacturers, and we tried the various 1176 hardware clones, and we tried also real 1176s. And it was so in the ballpark. You know, it on blind tests, it really did fool a lot of people. Like, a lot of people go, that's the Rev D. And you're like, well, no, that's the emulation of the Rev D. I suppose the only thing you don't get, which thing that I do notice, Waves put a button in to do it, does it? That the button that adds the original hiss.
Oh, God. The 50 hertz and the 60 hertz.
So people kind of go, oh, but it lacks the kind of warmth. And I think people misunderstand warmth. Really, what that is, it's just something is old and the capacitors are drying up a bit. So you're going to lose a bit of top end, which translates as warm. You kind of like, that's actually inaccurate. The newer one is way more sonically accurate than the old one. But again, EQs are so good now. If you want to roll a little bit of 10 hertz off, it absolutely works in a very musical way. Well, I think before, digital EQs just weren't musical. Okay. Whereas now they've really, you know, a lot of companies have really cracked how to make plugins become musical, and all the harmonic information doesn't get lost or is translated correctly. When the human ear hears it, it doesn't go, ooh, what's that? Something's not ringing with me on that. But at this stage now, plugins are just so developed. And the other thing is, I just got one of the new Apple MacBooks. And I was using the previous one, another Apple MacBook. And it was great. I could mix on it, but I'd always had to bounce things, or I used certain plugins, you know, that were processor heavy by various different manufacturers. I'd have to bounce in place or freeze them or do something. But now you can literally run, I've mixed loads of things on this and I've never had to freeze a track. And we're looking at, again, a laptop that was just over £1,000. It wasn't a super duper mega build or anything. So where we're at now is that we have the power available to run those plugins effortlessly, and they can be as DSP hungry as they need to be without the machine falling over after two instances or something like that. So let's say, for example, you're mixing the next big, you know, U2 or Coldplay record. Those things are kind of mixed by, not just one person is involved in the mix process. There's a council of people involved. So if you're constantly having to recall and someone goes, oh, the guitar is a bit quiet, or the hi-hat could be a bit brighter, or could you do this and do that? There's so many revisions. If you were mixing that in hardware, it's just not doable, you know, because you'd have to put the studio on hold for days on end and use, you know, hundreds of bits of chalk and taking pictures and all that. And that's just not realistic. So all those guys track through hardware, you know, they'll go through, you know, an original 67 and an original 1073. Sure. But the reality is, when they're mixing, is that 90% of mixing is done now in software, because of just the whole ease of recall. And all of the mixes retains the same. And you don't have that thing where, you know, drift as you get with analog synths or analog bits of gear that you turn them on the next day and the analog synths slightly out of tune or, you know, bits of old valve gear that just take 3 hours to warm up and they don't get to that optimum point until they're there. So you might have mixed through something like an original Fairchild, but it was at its sort of peak window. That's after 1 hour during the day. And after that, it's either not warm enough or it's too hot. So,
it used to be that you compare which plugins were better. Like, hey, which 1176 is the best? Now it's not even about that. You know, every one of them, like you said, has a sound, and it's more about picking, you know, the sound that you can get and how you use those specific plugins. It's not so much about who has the best emulation, because people are making new things. You know, I'm a fan of the, obviously the classic gear that's used to create all the stuff that got us into what we do. But I'm also a fan of the new stuff. And I don't think everything should be a emulation of something old, you know, because there are new things. It's kind of like a 60s Telecaster, right? Well, that had a sound too, but the new Telecasters also have a sound, you know? It's kind of like that, you know, where there's so much nostalgia behind old school things that sometimes people get lost in that. And then, like, with the plugins, there's so many. Yeah. You know, and if you don't know how to use them, it doesn't really matter how great it emulates the thing. You know, it's like, and I think that more so Robbie than myself, even, like, you know, you're used to working with this gear physically. So you know how, you already knew how to use it. When you saw a plugin, it was probably, you know, very easy for you to transition to, oh, that's the thing. And I know that button does this, you know. But a lot of people that haven't used it don't know that. And they get really wrapped up in the names and the nostalgia without actually diving into the functionality and, you know, making the best out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Like, again, I love plugins that don't have traditional interfaces. You know, that don't necessarily have to look like it was made in 1962 Isotope. Or whatever. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They came up with an AI mixing thing, which I experimented with. And I was kind of like, oh, this will be rubbish, nonsense. And I mixed the track with it. And it was about, it guessed me about 90%. I was like,
oh my goodness.
It was so good.
Virtual Robbie.
It was like, fantastic. No, because it learns what you do. It kind of goes, oh, this guy likes 3K a lot, doesn't he? And this guy likes pulling 2K out, and this guy likes doing this, and this guy likes pulling 200 by 5 dB. So it just copies your moves, essentially. And that's wild. Yeah. And then you mix the tracker, and you're like, damn, that's how damn. I mixed it.
Damn you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So yeah, you can kind of catch up with your normals and then just add the kind of the secret sauce on top.
Yeah, you know, or for guys who are doing production music, it's an absolute winner. Oh, yeah. You're like a 1-2-man team doing production music all day. You know what the demands of that are. You know, if it can be virtually mixed, as I say, to it being either ready as a very good demo or just needs, as I say, the last bit of secret sauce put on there, wow. You know, that's a major labor saver, you know?
Totally, totally. So we got all these amazing plugins that are saving time, and that, you know, it's unlike old analog gear, it doesn't depend what side of the bed they got out that morning. It just works. It's ready. You got total recall. It's, you know, huge convenience. And maybe we could draw a parallel between that and the world of record labels, because folks making music in their bedroom now, it used to be that they would, you know, depend very much on what side of bed the A&R man got out of, and if they liked them that week, they see them as something viable within these broader trends. But now folks can just go directly and release their music through amazing platforms like TuneCore. They can build communities through platforms like Patreon. I mean, Robbie, what are you kind of seeing in the world of distribution and how people are actually putting their music out there themselves directly from their home studios?
Yeah, I think the thing that sort of really, really brought that self-distribution thing to light was the 360 deal. Because the 360 deal really only works. The 360 deal, for anyone who's listening, is essentially the record label owns everything. So back in the day, they'd own your records, but if you went on tour, you could sell your own t-shirts and badges and hats or whatever else. But now, essentially, the label owns a percentage of everything. So I think with that, for artists who, you know, who just, you know, again, smaller fan base and so on, it just makes complete sense that the money goes into their pockets. So with, you know, Bandcamp and TuneCore and all those things, that they just make complete sense for independent artists. Sure. And the other thing we're seeing more of is the use of NFT and the blockchain for distribution as well.
Wow.
And especially around, like there's a token called Opulus, which is set up by a guy called Lee Parsons, which enables the fan base to own percentages of the royalties as well. And the interesting thing about NFTs is that the lifetime royalty can be built in for the artist. So if the track is sold on or synced, the artist will always get their percentage, no matter who it's sold on to, and that's fixed. So it's not a case of the blockchain can turn around and go, oh, sorry, mate, we don't have any money this month. It'll be written into the smart contract. So there's huge advantages around now that the onboarding processes and the adoption of blockchain technologies, and especially around NFTs, they've really, really changed, I think, how music and how people experience music in the future, whether it be ticketing or whether it be buying music or whether it be one-off special editions of things, enabling fans to have access to metaverses and so on and so forth, where they can completely experience the artist in a completely new and different way. I can see that really, really working for fan bases, where you have an independent artist that has a very, very strong fan base, and then, you know, the fan base will totally buy into the exclusivity aspect of what they're doing.
Yeah, very good point. Absolutely. And for anyone who's listening who wants to take a bit more of a deeper dive into the world of NFTs and the metaverse, we have episodes of Audio Talks about each of those, and we'll link in the show notes. And so, you know, we've obviously just come through quite a unique time in human history. There's been the pandemic, there's been the lockdowns, and, you know, we've discussed on the podcast before that music is a great comfort to people during the lockdown. It's also, there's been an explosion of creativity, and folks who have maybe been on tour or they've been doing a lot of promo, they've suddenly been, you know, virtually locked down, and they need to express themselves. They've been writing albums under the lockdown, and there's been a kind of positive silver lining to the cloud of the pandemic, if you like, in terms of creative work. Now, Damien, you have the kind of inside view from within Harman. I mean, have you seen any changes that the pandemic has been accelerating in terms of what people are using, what kind of equipment they're interested in, what kind of stuff they're making at home?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's any secret that USB microphones, obviously we've as at Harman, within AKG brand, we've released two USB microphones during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And the timing was perfect. People needed things that, something that they can use at home that they didn't have to learn how to do or learn how to use per se. You know, with a typical signal chain, you're going to need at least a microphone, a preamp, and an interface or an interface with a preamp.
Yeah.
Well, a USB microphone takes that away and it opens up the palette of creative users to, you know, people that have no idea what sound is, what microphones are, what studio monitors are, and they honestly don't care and shouldn't care. They just want, you know, they just want something that, that they could use. And then, you know, I think just taking it away from any specific industry, you know, people are at home bored, you know, spending more time with their family than they're probably used to, more time with themselves than they're probably used to. So a quiet mind is a creative mind in a lot of ways, because, you know, when you kind of remove that clutter, you know, you go there. And if I'm someone who's been thinking about recording a podcast for the last, you know, four or five years, but had no idea how where to start, if someone comes along and says, hey, if you spend $150 on this microphone and plug this one cable into your computer, you can record a podcast. You know, that's that's a no-brainer, you know. And when people start to explore that and realize how easy that is, that kind of introduces other, you know, people to other parts of creativity. You know, what if they wanted to start producing? And they find out, oh, I can get a copy of a really great production software for pretty cheap and a really cool keyboard controller. And, you know, for under $500, now I can, you know, start tinkering around with things that I've been thinking about for 5 years. The barrier of entry is just is low. And, you know, products like, you know, specifically our AKG USB microphones are, you know, some of the perfect things to get people started, because it just doesn't require a lot of brain power, if you will, you know. And then once you get into that, it's kind of like, you know, like Robbie mentioned earlier, when we started playing music, you start to learn all these other, you know, how to mic a guitar amp and, you know, where that goes. And so the initial interest in recording opens the door to other avenues of creativity, and people discover that there's so much that they can do without physically stepping inside of a studio.
Yeah, absolutely. And to kind of prove the point, all three of us are actually using AKG Lyra mics at this moment to record the Audio Talks podcast, which is lovely. And so, Robbie, coming over to yourself now, I see a lot of the stuff that you're mastering, folks like Drew Young, you know, some great artists. You're mixing, you're writing, you're really very prolific in terms of, you know, the music you release. But have there been any lockdown albums that you've really thought just totally nailed it?
I really like the Nick Cave Warren Ellis one.
Nice.
Carnage. That's really, really good. Very atmospheric. Reminds me, you mentioned Eno earlier, and Eno's old collaborator, Danny Lemoine, I'm totally obsessed with. And he was one of the, you know, again, pioneers of the whole home studio thing, or recording in houses, you know, and whether it be, you know, like as far back as things like the Unforgettable Four by U2, which, you know, they're recording in Slane Castle, because he just didn't want to use a traditional space to do it. And his stuff always, again, it reminds me of that, has that kind of atmosphere to it, you know. And I think the one brilliant thing about home recording and the lockdown, and related to lockdown, is everyone had time on their hands.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're recording at home, you're not really looking at the clock at all, you know, especially during lockdown, you know, because there was not much else to do apart from think about what you're going to have for dinner or find ways of filling your hours otherwise. There was so much content made during lockdown, whether it be records or whether it be, you know, spoken word stuff or whether it be video content. The fact that technology is so available and technology just works now, you know, going back to the mics we're talking about today, like, it is a case of opening the box, plugging in the cable and off you go.
So, Robbie, you mentioned your magnificent obsession with Daniel Lanois, and that's such a good obsession to have. He's an absolute genius. And, you know, he uses the space, he sets it up in the right way. He basically builds recording studios in houses or spaces to record amazing acts. Yeah.
He just rarely uses traditional studio spaces.
Wow.
But, you know, you look at the artists he works with, it's Neil Young, it's U2, it's Bob Dylan, you know. it's all about making those guys as comfortable as possible for the creative process, you know. And they don't really want to be in a place with grey carpets on the wall and the clock ticking away. So,
expensive cappuccinos. No, it's all about capturing a kind of unique vibe and getting the space right. But what, I mean, Robbie, you've helped a lot of people who've maybe got a record deal, or they've just decided they want to invest in their creative work and they want to have a good home setup. What are some of the pillars or like the basic principles that you tell the folks that you advise? Because you've done this a lot of times. Is there any specific bits of advice that you'd share with our listeners?
Yeah, but essentially only buy what you need and buy the best quality of what you can.
Very good.
So rather than just filling the space up with, you know, loads of cheap microphones and four pairs of cheap speakers, just get one really good pair of speakers. Get a, you know, as good a converter as you can. If you've got money left over, a mic pre, wonderful. Again, same with microphones. You know, the days of just having blinking lights for the sake of having blinking lights are gone, you know? So really, as good as a computer, you can really, because right now, all, you know, the reality is not unless you're recording full band setups, which you're not going to do in a home setup, not unless you're in the middle of nowhere or something like that. But generally, you know, most people make their albums in their bedrooms, in apartments or houses or wherever. You know, you've got to have the limitations of neighbors next door. So really just getting your monitoring as good as you can. If you can't, you know, start hammering panels into the wall because of the rented apartment and so on, there's loads of great room correction software out there for very little money now as well. So best pair of monitors you can get, some room correction software if you can, and then as good as conversion as you can get, really. And then if you've got like money left over, well, then you can get nice things like, you know, a nice mic pre or maybe a channel strip or a compressor or something like that. But the reality is, as we said earlier about plugins, the plugins are so there at this stage that it's not an over-essential. And the other thing we're not battling with anymore either is hiss.
Oh,
you
know,
if you remember hiss back in the day. Dolby C. Remember Dolby C? There's all your top end gone. Forget about having any cymbals. They're all gone now.
It's vintage.
So we're not battling with that, you know, trying to find out, getting rid of that. That's all gone. You know, like the headroom on modern conversion is absolutely huge, you know? And again, as Damien's saying, just try and get your head around gain staging. Really, that's as important. Because really, all you want to get is a really good, clean signal into your computer. And after that, you can do what you want.
Yeah.
Because you can't undirty, you know, if something goes in dirty and clipping and all that, I suppose you couldn't use things like Isotope to fix it, but it's not ideal because you're taking away a lot of the information. But you can make something, you know, if you get something clean, you can make it as dirty as you want after. You can overdrive it or, you know, bit crush it or whatever you want to do if you really want to make things dirtier, run it in parallel or whatever else. But that really what you want to get is as good a clean signal into your computer as possible. And from there, you know, you can bend and shape the sound. As we know, in any DAW now, you can bend it any way you want, you know, slow it down, speed it up, change the pitch. Audio is completely elastic at this stage, you know. It goes as far as your imagination goes, really. So, the main thing I say is get as good a pair of speakers and a good a converter and as good a computer. And then whatever DAW works for you, because they're all slightly different, but they all do the same thing. But, you know, even with the stock plugins now, most DAWs, you could happily make a record.
That's so true. You know, I think stock plugins are so underrated because, you know, a 6-band EQ is kind of a 6-band EQ, right? If you think you need a 10-band EQ or whatever, like, you know, they all kind of do the same thing. If you know how to use that, then you're fine. It doesn't really matter. You know, if you want some extra coloration or a specific EQ has a modeled curve, that's one thing. But overall, like, I think stock plugins are definitely underrated. Again, it goes back to necessity being the mother of invention. You know, there are some rules, but overall, if you can get a great sound, you don't need a ton of stuff. And I think people getting into it are just starting to record at home. They don't know that, you know, and I don't blame them because, a lot of companies really heavily market the different emulations and the thises and the thats. But the reality is that, you know, if you get GarageBand or Logic Pro, you don't really have to buy at least starting out.
Very, very little.
Definitely not against, you know, plug-in companies by any stretch. But if you can learn how to use the stock plugins and really make something shine with that, then getting additional, you know, plugins is only going to make it better.
Absolutely. That's good. So like, don't ignore the foundational ingredients, you know, your room. You don't need to get a ton of stuff. Just concentrate, be brilliant at the basics, get the best gear you can afford, and don't ignore those magnificent stock plugins, particularly with DAWs like Logic Pro, which is just brilliant. And Damien, staying with yourself there, you know, obviously you've got the JBL professional viewpoint. Say if somebody's listening and they're thinking, right, I'm going to sort myself out with a pair of studio monitors. Is there like a range? Are there any particular models you recommend for like a beginner, an enthusiast, and then, you know, somebody approaching the pro level? Where should they look?
Yeah, so for us, our flagship studio monitors are going to be the 3 Series Mark II. So we've got a 305, a 306, and a 308, mm-hmm. As well as a 310 subwoofer. The 305's a pair, I believe you can get for, you know, sub $300. Mm-hmm. So extremely affordable. They sound amazing. I have some sitting in front of me right now for obvious reasons. It's one of our premier studio monitor lines, and they're, you know, essentially under $500, and you just can't go wrong with them. You know, they're powered. You plug them into your interface, and you're good to go. When you start to approach some of the more high-end needs, you're talking about speakers that can handle higher SPL outputs. Mm-hmm. That have, you know, a slightly different coverage patterns, et cetera. So, you know, for that, we have the 705 and the 708s, which are going to be for different needs. You have your bedroom studios, which are geared for the 3 Series type. And then a lot of large post-production facilities use our 7 Series monitors because they feature a compression driver in the horn, which is not something that any other studio monitor that I know of has. That's something that you typically find on live sound speakers because live sound speakers need that SPL. We have them in a studio monitor. So what we found is they've been really successful, like in the post-production houses, mm-hmm. Use them for, you know, for the Atmos mixes and all the way down to stereo mixes.
Nice. Okay. That's a nice range there for the folks listening. That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you. And back in the 90s, my home studio had like that cassette tape multi-track unit. It had a computer with 4 megabytes of RAM that took half an hour to warm up. It all cost a small fortune. But for the folks listening today, they are going to get so much more bang for their buck. So Damien, is there anything that you would kind of hint to or point at that's coming next from the boffins at JBL, DBX, Harman, Studer, AKG, Lexicon, all that group of companies you work with? Is there any cool stuff coming up that the folks listening should know about?
Yes, there's some cool stuff coming up. Unfortunately, a lot of the things I can't talk about. I will say that as a company, we're looking, what does the future hold? You know, obviously, most content is coming out in various forms of immersive audio mixes and Atmos and whatnot. So I think from a consumer perspective, you know, and just what the market is doing, what the industry is doing, is that, you know, people are consuming audio in more than stereo right now. You know, all of us talking right now came up in an era where stereo was just, that was all it was, you know, and now the consumption is going towards consuming audio in immersive formats. So we want to stay ahead of that and make sure that we're creating products that are actually solving problems or meeting a need rather than just doing me too products that are just something to follow on the coattails of other vendors.
Okay, that's good. That's given us an intriguing glimpse into the future without giving away any trade secrets. So well answered there, sir. Brilliant. And finally, I'd like to give you both a blank canvas. What piece of studio equipment does the world need right now? And we'll start with yourself, Robbie.
Yeah, because I was watching Rick Beato the other day and he was doing a rundown of the top 20 on Spotify. Yeah. And he discovered that I think it was 16 of the songs had the same 4 chords just in slightly different keys. So I think I would have a butt of some sort or a piece of gear of some sort that would add just maybe an extra couple of chords and maybe the odd middle 8 and a coda to the current top 20.
Genius idea, Robbie.
Turn everything into Steely Dan. What do you mean it doesn't sound like Steely Dan?
Wow.
Yes, please. Oh, yeah. We had Denise Bent, the studio engineer from Asia, on the podcast in a previous episode. She was just fantastic,
man. Wow. You know,
to be a fly on that wall. And Damien, coming over to yourself, so we've got our kind of magical chord button or plug-in from Robbie there. Yeah. What are you going to add to the studio?
Ooh, you know, I think every studio needs a USB microphone. You know, as far as equipment is concerned, I'm a big fan of people taking the time and just learning how to use very simple tools, you know, compression, EQ, et cetera. I think that's what's going to really improve the overall quality of what we hear coming out of people's home studios because, you know, everyone can't afford to you know, spend $50,000 treating a room you know, doing an acoustic treatment on a room. So, and then also everyone can't afford to pay, you know, $1,000 for a channel strip that they're going to use, you know, only to record, you know, again, like podcasts and things like that. So I think one would be a USB microphone. Two, it really isn't a piece of equipment, but just, you know, users going back to learning what the tools are and how to use them. You know, the basic functions of compression, limiting, gain staging, and EQ. And I think that would really help because, you know, back to kind of rewinding a little bit, creators are able to release their music and curate their own audiences, right? So, you know, a label isn't necessary in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously there's a benefit to that, but you can still be a creator and curate your audience. And if you're a live act, you can still go gig and not do terrible. You know, some of the current acts that I'm listening to are not acts that are on major labels that you would ever hear on terrestrial radio. These are, you know, a lot, but they're able to go to a large city and sell out the largest venue or the largest venues in large cities. You know, that says something. That says something about the power of curation and about, you know, understanding that being inside of a home or an apartment or whatnot is not the ceiling of creativity. You can do whatever you want.
Nice. I like it. So, you know, it sounds like one of the most important pieces of equipment is actually what's between your ears.
Absolutely.
Creativity is king.
Most definitely.
A Tom Waits plugin.
Oh, mate, now you're talking. Yes, please. Take my money. Wonderful. We've come to the end and I've got one more question for each of you. And it's one that we ask all of our VIP guests, and that is to choose a track for our very special Audio Talks title playlist. So it can be one of your own tracks, one you use to calibrate your setup, or just something that rocks your world. And we're going to start with yourself, Robbie. What track are you going to stick on our title playlist?
Since I was harping on about Danny Lanois, I'm going to go with Slow Giving by Danny Lanois.
Immense.
Wow.
What I love about it is that you can hear the amps buzzing and stuff. Just you can hear them just very gently distorting and moving. And when, you know, the louder he plays, because he plays the guitar. If you've watched him play guitar, he plays in a very odd, unique, very dynamic sort of way, you know. So where he plays from this incredibly gentle, barely touching into the really attacking. And you can really hear the amp reacting to his playing.
Wow.
And you could hear the room and everything. So it's, you can hear all the kind of the imperfections of what makes it really interesting, because it's, you hear things that you don't normally hear on a record per se. So
nice. I love it. I'm absolutely going to have a proper listen to that on my favorite AKG headphones a bit later. And Damien, what say you? What track are you going to add to our title playlist?
Oh, man. There's so many. I'm going to give you one that I've been listening to probably for the last little year or so here that comes up on my playlist often. And it's a song by an artist named Saint Vincent, who's an incredible guitar player. She's amazing. And she has a new song, well, relatively new song, called Pay Your Way in Pain.
Oh, fantastic. In keeping with the theme of the podcast, I'm going to choose a track that was recorded by a gentleman called Justin Vernon in his dad's cabin in Wisconsin. He's also known as Bon Iver. The track is Restax from the album For Emma Forever Ago. So thank you so much for joining us on Audio Talks presented by Harman. Damien Curry.
Thank you so much, guys. You guys are awesome. Appreciate it.
Back at you. And Robbie Dunn.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed that. That was a wonderful chat.
Awesome. Back at you both. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you for joining us. It's been wonderful. Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment, and share with your friends and family. If you're feeling like doing Audio Talks a solid, get yourself over to wherever you get your podcasts, like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and leave a nice review for us. Also, for more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us on Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for some more fascinating Audio Talks. See you next time.